their apparently mystical experiences were, in fact, events of their own creation.
Yes, Dom said. We know the power's in us, me and Brendan. But where does it come from, Dr. Bunnell?
You don't know?
I think it has something to do with what happened to us when we went in the ship, but I can't remember. Can't you tell me?
No, Miles Bunnell said. Not really. It was known that three of you went into the vessel, but we didn't know that anything peculiar had happened to you in there. You'd come out just as the helicopters with Dero troops and scientific observers began to arrive on the site, and no one figured you'd been in there more than a couple minutes. When you were taken into custody, you didn't tell anyone that something important had happened while you'd been aboard. I believe you said you'd just looked around. And for ease of handling, you were all sedated immediately after being arrested and conveyed back to the Tranquility. So even if you had changed your mind and decided to tell us what happened, you didn't have a chance. Excited, the lanky scientist absent-mindedly began to comb his long fingers through his curly black beard as he talked. When the decision was made to put a lid on the event, to brainwash every civilian who'd seen it, there wasn't time for a thorough debriefing of all the witnesses. In fact, you were never brought out of sedation. You were moved directly onto the drug program that was part of your memory wipe. That's one reason I was opposed to the cover-up. I felt that by brainwashing you without giving us plenty of time to debrief, well, it was not only unfair and cruel to you, but a really stupid waste of potential sources of data. Ginger looked toward the open portal farther along the flank of the vessel, at the top of the portable stairs.
If we go back inside now, maybe the last of the memory block will crumble.
That might help, Bunnell agreed.
Looking up at the starship again, Jack said,
How'd you know I was coming down out there, along I-80?
Yeah, Dom said. And why'd they think it should be covered up?
And the creatures who came in it, Jack said.
God, yes, Ginger said. Where are they? What's happened to them?
Interrupting, General Alvarado said,
Like Miles said, you'll get the answers because you deserve them. But first, there's more urgent business.
He turned to Dom.
I suppose if you can levitate things and create light out of thin air, there's no problem getting through an electronic security system. And if you can get in, you ought to be able to use your power to keep other people out. You think you could? Keep both the blast doors and the smaller entrance from opening until we're ready to open them?
Dom was clearly as baffled by these questions as Ginger was. He said,
Well, maybe, I don't know.
Bunnell looked at the general.
Bob, if you keep the colonel out, that'll be like lighting the fuse. He knows no one can control Vigilant but him. If he can't get in, it'll look like voodoo to him. He'll be sure we're all infected.
Infected?
Ginger said uneasily.
Alvarado said, The colonel is convinced that we, you, me, Miles, all of us, have been somehow possessed by alien beings, taken over like a bunch of puppets, and that we're not human anymore.
That's insane, Jack said.
But with greater uneasiness, Ginger said,
Of course, we know we haven't been. But is there reason to believe it could have happened?
Initially, yes, some small reason, Miles Bunnell said. But it didn't happen. It's not true. And we understand now that it was never a possibility, just typical black-minded human nature, putting the worst interpretation on everything. I'll explain later.
Ginger was about to demand an immediate explanation, but General Alvarado said,
Please hold the questions. We don't have much time. Right now, we believe Falkirk is returning here, having taken your friends into custody.
No, Dom said. They got away before we did. They're gone.
Never underestimate the colonel, Alvarado said. But see, the thing is, if Dom could use his power to shut down the entrances and keep Falkirk out, maybe we'd have the time to find a way to blow this whole story wide open. Because if he gets in here, I'm afraid there's going to be bloodshed, one way or another.
Movement at the front of the chamber caught Ginger's attention, and she gasped in dismay when she saw Georgia, Marcy, Brendan, and then all the others coming in through the small door in the big door.
"Too late," Miles Bunnell said. "Too late."
At the entrance to Thunderhill Depository, the seven witnesses and Parker Fane were taken out of the transport and grouped in the snow in front of the smaller steel door. Lieutenant Horner's machine gun discouraged flight and resistance. Leland ordered the other Dero men back to Schenkfield, where they were to bury Stefan Vikazic in an unmarked grave and await further orders. But no orders would be forthcoming from Leland, for he would not be alive to give them. It was not necessary to sacrifice the entire company, for just he and one other man could control the prisoners and destroy the entire depository, and it was Lieutenant Horner's bad luck to be second in command and have that responsibility fall upon his shoulders. In the entrance tunnel, Leland was alarmed to see that the video cameras were not working, but then he realized that the new emergency program under which Vigilant was operating did not require visual ID for admittance, for it would respond only to one key, the prints of the palm and all the fingers on Leland's left hand. When he put his palm to the glass panel beside the inner door, Vigilant admitted him at once. He and Horner took the eight prisoners down to the second level and across the hub to the cavern where Alvarado and Bunnell waited. As Leland stood back and watched them file through the man-sized door in the huge wooden wall, he looked beyond them and saw the other witnesses, Corvaces, Weiss, and Twist. And although he did not know how they had gotten here, he was exhilarated by the realization that, contrary to expectations, he had the whole group exactly where he wanted them. He left Horner to follow the prisoners while he hurried back to the elevators. He could never trust poor Tom again, not now that the lieutenant had been alone with people who might be contaminated. Carrying his submachine gun at the ready, Leland took a smaller elevator down to the third level. He intended to kill anyone who moved toward him, and if they rushed him in great numbers, he would turn the gun on himself. He wouldn't let himself be changed. Through childhood and adolescence, his parents had striven to change him into one of them, a shouter and wailer in churches, a self-flagellator, a God-terrorized speaker of tongues. He had resisted the changes his parents would have wrought in him, and he would not be changed now. They had been after him all his life, in one guise or another, and they would not get him after he had come this far with his identity and dignity intact. The bottom level of Thunderhill Depository was given over entirely to the storage of supplies, munitions, and explosives. Staff members all lived on the second level, and most worked there as well. However, at any hour of the day, a few workers and a guard were usually on duty on the third and lowest floor. When Leland stepped out of the elevator into the central cavern off which other chambers opened, an arrangement much like that on the second floor, he was pleased to see the basement was deserted tonight. General Alvarado had obeyed Leland's orders and had sent all of his people to their quarters. Alvarado probably thought that by cooperating he could convince Leland that he and all his people were unquestionably human. But Leland was not naive enough to be taken in by such a ruse. His own parents had been capable of behaving like normal human beings, too. Oh, yes, smiles and plenty of sweet talk, oaths of love and affection. And just when you started to think they actually cared about you and wanted the best for you, they'd suddenly reveal themselves for what they really were. They would get out the leather strap or the ping-pong paddle in which the old man had drilled holes, and the beatings would be administered in the name of God. Leland Falkirk couldn't be easily deceived by a masquerade of humanity, for at an early age he had learned to look for, in fact, to expect, an inhuman presence below the skin of normality. Crossing the main cavern to the massive steel blast door that sealed off the munitions room, Leland looked nervously left and right and up into the darkness between the lights. One of his punishments, as a child, had been long imprisonments in a windowless coal cellar. Leland pressed his left hand to the glass panel beside the door, which rolled open. Banks of lights flickered on automatically down the length of a room piled 20 feet high with anchored crates and drums and racks that contained live ammunition, mortar shells, grenades, mines, and other instruments of destruction. At the end of the long chamber was a 20-foot square vault that also required a palm ID to be opened. The weapons within were of such deadly magnitude that only 8 people out of the hundreds in Thunderhill were authorized to enter, and no one of them alone could open the vault. The system required 3 of the 8 to apply their palms to the glass panel one after another within 1 minute before access would be granted. But this also was overseen by Vigilant, and the computer's new program, designed by Leland, made him the sole keeper of the depository's tactical nuclear arsenal. He put his palm to the cool glass, and 15 seconds later, the many-layered, steel Magruder vault door swung slowly open with a hum of electric motors. To the right of the vault door, 20 backpack nukes hung on wall pegs, missing only their primary detonators and their binary packages of explosive material. The detonators were stored in drawers along the back wall. To the left of the door, in lead-lined cabinets, the binary packages lay waiting for Armageddon. Dero training included familiarization with a variety of nuclear devices that terrorists might conceivably plant in American cities, so Leland knew how to assemble, arm, and disarm the bomb in virtually all of its design permutations. He got the components from the cabinets, took 2 backpack bomb frames down from the wall pegs, and put together both weapons in only 8 minutes, glancing nervously at the door as he worked. He breathed easier only when he had set the timers on both detonators for 15 minutes and had started the clocks. He slung a submachine gun over his shoulder, slipped each arm into the straps of a backpack nuke. Each device weighed 69 pounds. He heaved both off the floor and lurched out of the vault, bent like a hunchback and grunting under that apocalyptic weight. Another man might have had to stop 2 or 3 times during the journey back through the immense munitions room. Any other man might have been forced to pause, put the bombs down, catch his breath and stretch his muscles before going on, but not Leland Falkirk. That dead weight wrenched his back and pulled at his shoulders and made his arms ache, but he grew happier as the pain intensified. In the main cavern into which the elevators opened, he put one of the backpack nukes on the center of the floor. He looked around at the solid rock walls and up at the granite ceiling with a feeling of satisfaction. If there were any faults at all in the rock strata, and surely there were, the place would cave in, bringing everything above down with it. But even if the mighty stone chambers could contain and withstand the blast, no one who tried to take refuge on this level would survive. Not even an alien life form of great adaptability could reconstitute itself after being vaporized in a nuclear heat and reduced to random atoms. Nuclear pain. He would not be able to survive it, but he would prove that he had the nerve to contemplate and endure it. Only a fraction of a second of blinding agony. Not bad, actually. In fact, not as bad as vigorous and drawn-out beatings with a leather strap, or with a ping-pong paddle that had been drilled full of holes to increase the sting. Still holding the second nuke by its straps, Leland smiled down at the changing numbers on the first bomb's digital display clock, which was already counting toward Ragnarok. The nicest thing about backpack nukes was that, once armed, they could not be disarmed. He did not have to worry that someone could undo his work. He entered the elevator and rode up to the second level. Carrying Marcy, Georgia crossed directly to Jack Twist and stood beside him, looking up at the ship cradled on trestles. Although the collapse of her memory block and the inrushing recollections had more or less prepared her for this sight, she was overcome with an awe as powerful as that which had seized her in the troop transport when the astounding truth had first been revealed. She reached out to touch the mottled hull, and a shiver, part fear, part wonder, part delight, coursed through her when her fingertips made contact with the scorched and abraded metal. Whether following her mother's lead or acting on an impulse of her own, Marcy reached forward too. When her small, tentative hand pressed against the hull, she said,
"The moon. The moon."
"Yes," Georgia said immediately.
"Yes, honey. This is what you saw come down. Remember? It wasn't the moon falling. It was this, glowing white like the moon, then red, then amber." "Moon," the child said softly,
sliding her tiny hand back and forth across the flank of the vessel, as if she were trying to clean off the mottled film of age and tribulation and thereby also clean off the clouded surface of her own memory.
"Moon fell down. Not the moon, honey. A ship. A very special ship. A spaceship, like in the movies, baby."
Marcy turned and looked at Georgia. Actually, looked at her, with eyes that were no longer out of focus or turned inward.
"Like Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock?"
Georgia smiled and hugged her tighter.
"Yes, honey. Like Captain Kirk. And Mr. Spock."
"Like Luke Skywalker,"
Jack said, leaning forward and pushing a lock of hair out of the girl's eyes.
"Luke,"
Marcy said.
"And Han Solo," Jack said.
The child's eyes blurred out of focus. She had returned to her private place to contemplate the news she had just received. Jack smiled at Georgia and said,
"She's gonna be all right. It may take time. But she'll be all right, because her whole obsession was a struggle to remember. Now she's begun to remember, and she doesn't need to struggle anymore."
As usual, Georgia was reassured merely by his presence, by his aura of calm competence.
"She'll be all right, if we can get out of here alive and with our memories intact."
"We will," Jack said. "Somehow."
A rush of warm emotion filled Dom when he saw Parker. He embraced the stocky artist and said,
"How in God's name did you wind up here, my friend?"
"It's a long story," Parker said.
A sorrow in his face and eyes said, better than words, that at least part of the story was bleak.
"I didn't mean to get you so deep in this trouble," Dom said.
Looking up at the starship, Parker said,
"I wouldn't have missed it for the world."
"What happened to your beard?"
"When this kind of company's coming,"
Parker said, gesturing at the ship,
"they're worth shaving for."
Ernie moved along the side of the starship, staring, touching. Faye stayed with Brendan, for she was concerned about him. Months ago he had lost his faith, or had thought he'd lost it, which was just as bad for him. And tonight he had lost Father Vikazic, a blow that had left him hollow-eyed and shaky.
"Fay,"
he said, looking up at the ship,
"it's truly wonderful, isn't it?"
"Yes,"
she said.
"I never was one for stories about other worlds.
never gave much thought to what it would mean. But it's the end of everything, and the start of something new. Wonderful and new.
But it's not God, he said. And in my heart that's what I had hoped it would be.
She took his hand. Remember the message that Parker brought you from Father Vikazik? What he told you in the truck? Father Vikazik knew what had happened, what had come down that night, and for him it was a reaffirmation of his faith.
Brendan smiled forlornly.
For him everything was a reaffirmation of his faith.
Then it'll also be a reaffirmation for you, she told him. You just need time, a little time to think about it. Then you'll see it the same way Father Vikazik did, because, though you aren't aware of it, you are a lot like him.
He looked at her, surprised.
Not me. You didn't know him. I'm not half the priest, not half the man that he was.
Faye smiled and pinched his cheek affectionately.
Brendan, when you told us all about your rector, it was clear how much you admired him. And within one day, it was also clear that you were more like him than you realized. You're young, Brendan, you've still got things to learn, but when you're Father Vikazik's age, you're going to be the man and the priest that he was, and every day of your life is going to be a living testament to him.
A fragile hopefulness replaced his despair. His mouth trembled and his voice cracked.
You really think so?
I know it.
He put his arms around her, and she hugged him. Ned and Sandy stood with their arms around each other's waists, looking up at the ship. Neither spoke, because nothing more needed to be said. At least, that's the way it seemed to him. Then Sandy said something that did need to be said.
Ned, if we get out of this alive, I want to go see a doctor. You know, one of those fertility experts. I want to do whatever I can to bring a baby into the world.
But you've always... You never...
I never liked the world enough before, she said softly. But now, I want a part of us to be there when our kind go out to ride on top of all the darkness, to other worlds, maybe to meet the strangers, the wonderful strangers who came in this. I'll be a real good mother, Ned.
I know you will. When Miles Bunnell saw the last of the witnesses and Parker Fane filing into the chamber, he gave up hope of employing Dom Curvasis's new powers to freeze Falkirk out of Thunder Hill. He would have to rely, instead, on the .357 Magnum that was tucked into his belt. It pressed hard against his stomach, hidden beneath his loose, white lab coat. Miles thought Leland would come with at least 20 men, probably twice that number. He expected the colonel, Horner, and half a dozen soldiers to enter the chamber behind the last of the witnesses. But only Horner appeared, toting a submachine gun and prepared to use it. As the Blocks, the Sarvers, Brendan Cronin, and the others were drawn instantly and irresistibly to the starship, Horner said,
General Alvarado, Dr. Bunnell, Colonel Falkirk will be along in a moment.
How dare you come in here with an automatic weapon at the ready, Bob said with an aplomb Miles admired. Good God, man, don't you realize if your finger slipped and you let off a burst, the slugs would keep ricocheting off these rock walls, killing all of us, you included?
My finger never slips, sir, Horner said, in such a way that he was virtually challenging Bob to make an issue of it. Instead, Bob said sharply,
Where's Falkirk?
Sir, the colonel had some things to attend to. He apologizes for keeping you waiting. He'll join us shortly.
What things? Bob Alvarado asked.
Sir, the colonel doesn't always consult me about his every move.
Miles was half afraid Falkirk had already taken squads of Dero troops to liquidate the staff. But that grim possibility seemed less likely with every second that passed, unmarred by the rattle of gunfire. He was a heavily armed man, looking for a chance to turn the tables on his enemies. But he did not want to appear that way to Horner. So Miles decided the most natural thing to do would be to talk with the witnesses and begin to answer some of the many questions they had. He discovered that most of them had already heard about the CISG, so he quickly summarized the findings of that committee for the others, by way of explaining why the cover-up had initially been ordered. The ship before them, Miles explained, had first been spotted by deeply positioned defense satellites orbiting the Earth at a distance of more than 22,000 miles. They had seen it coming in past the moon. The Soviets, whose defense satellites were cruder, did not spot the visitor until much later, and never accurately identified it. Initially, observers thought the alien craft was a large meteorite or small asteroid on a collision course with Earth. If it was a soft, porous material, it might burn up during descent. And even if Earth were unlucky, if the incoming debris was made of more solid stuff, it still might fragment into a host of small and relatively harmless meteorites. However, if Earth were very unlucky, if the wandering rock had a high nickel-iron content, which might eliminate the possibility of extensive fragmentation, it was definitely a menace. Of course, it was almost certain to hit water, since oceans covered 70% of the planet's surface. Water impact would result in little damage, unless it hit close enough to shore for its tsunami to devastate a port. The worst-case possibility was a land strike in a heavily populated area. Imagine a lump of nickel and iron, the size of a bus hurtling into the heart of Manhattan at a couple of thousand miles an hour, Miles told them. That picture was horrifying enough to make us consider measures to destroy or deflect it. Less than 6 months earlier, the first satellites in the nation's strategic defense shield had been placed secretly in orbit. They had comprised less than 10% of the system as it would be ultimately constituted, and on their own they could not have done much to prevent nuclear war. But thanks to several forward-thinking designers, every satellite had been given high maneuverability that would allow it to turn its armaments outward and double as a planetary defense against just such a threat as that hurtling piece of space junk. Recent theory proposed that impacting comets or asteroids had wiped out the dinosaurs, and prudent planners had decided it might be wise to use the strategic defense shield to knock down not only Soviet missiles, but the fate-flung missiles of the universe itself. Therefore, one of the satellites was repositioned while the meteorite streaked nearer Earth, and plans were laid to fire all of its anti-missile missiles at the intruder. Although none of those projectiles was nuclear, their explosive warheads in combination were believed sufficient to fragment the meteorite into enough pieces to ensure that none would be large enough to reach the surface of Earth with destructive potential. Then, Miles said, hours before the scheduled attack on the intruder, an analysis of the latest photographs indicated a shockingly symmetrical shape, and spectrographic readings forwarded by the satellite began to confirm that it might be something stranger than a meteorite. Its analysis did not match any of the standard profiles for meteorites. He had walked among the witnesses as he talked, and now he put one hand upon the flank of the ship, still capable of being awed by it even after 18 months. New photos were ordered every 10 minutes. During the following hour, the approaching shape grew ever more distinct until the likelihood of it being a ship was so great that no one would risk ordering its destruction. We hadn't informed the Soviets of the object or of our intention to destroy it, for that would have given them information about our defense satellite capabilities. Now, we purposefully began random jamming of Soviet high-atmosphere radar, dropping bogies and electronic shadows on them, to cover the ship's advance and thus keep the secret of its visit. At first, we thought it would take up orbit around Earth. But very late in the game, we realized it was going to come straight in, following the very path an unpowered meteorite would have followed, though in a controlled fashion. Defense computers were able to give a 38-minute warning that point of impact would be here in Elko County.
"Just enough time to close I-80, Ernie Block said, "and call Falkirk and his Dero men in from wherever they were."
"Idaho," Miles said.
They were on training maneuvers in southern Idaho, fortunately quite close. Or unfortunately, depending on your point of view.
"Of course, Dr. Bunnell, I know your point of view," said Leland Falkirk from the door where he had at last appeared.
The 357 Magnum felt as big as a cannon against Miles Bunnell's belly, but suddenly it seemed as useless as a pea shooter. Upon seeing Leland Falkirk for the first time, Ginger realized how little justice the newspaper photograph had done him. He was handsomer, more imposing, and more frightening than he'd appeared in the Sentinel. He didn't carry his submachine gun in the stern attitude of readiness that Horner affected, nonchalantly dangling it in one hand. However, his apparent laxity was more threatening than Horner's posturing. Ginger had the feeling that, by seeming to be careless, he was taunting them to try something. As Falkirk drew nearer the group, Ginger thought that he brought with him a palpable aura, and almost a stench of hatred and madness. Dr. Bunnell said, "Where are all your men, Colonel?"
"No man," Falkirk said mildly. "Just Lieutenant Horner and me. No need for a display of force, really. I'm quite sure that when we've had time to discuss the situation rationally, we'll reach a solution to the problem that will satisfy everyone."
Ginger had an even stronger feeling that the colonel was taunting them. He had the air of a child who, in possession of a secret, not only takes enormous pleasure in his special knowledge, but is especially tickled by the ignorance of others. She saw that Dr. Bunnell seemed baffled by Falkirk's behavior and wary of him.
"Go on with your discussion," the colonel said, checking his watch. "For heaven's sake, don't let me interrupt. You must have 1,000 questions you'd like Dr. Bunnell to answer."
"I have one," Sandy said. "Doctor, where are the people who came in this ship?"
"Dead,"
Bunnell said.
"There were 8 of them, but they were all dead before they got here."
A pang of regret pierced Ginger's heart, and from their expressions she saw that the others were equally shocked and disappointed. Parker and Georgia even groaned softly, as if they had just been given news of a friend's death.
"How did they die?" Ned asked.
"Of what?"
Glancing repeatedly at Colonel Falkirk, Bunnell said,
"Well, first you've got to know a little about them, about why they came in the first place. In their ship we found a virtual encyclopedia of their species, a crash course in their culture, biology, psychology, recorded on something like our own video discs. We required a couple of weeks to even identify the player, and a month to learn how to operate it. But once we figured it out, we found the machine still operable. Astonishing when you consider... well, better not jump ahead. Suffice to say, we're still going through the trove of material on those discs. It's superbly visual, explaining so much in spite of the language barrier, though it also slowly teaches their language. Those of us on the project almost feel a brotherhood with the people who built this ship." Colonel Falkirk laughed sourly. Mockingly, he said,
"Brotherhood."
Dr. Bunnell glared at him, then continued, "I'd need weeks to tell you what we know of them now. Suffice to say, they're an unimaginably ancient
space-going species which had, at the time this ship departed its home port, searched out and located 5 other intelligent species in other solar systems than their own.
5?
Ginger said in amazement.
But even if the galaxy is positively packed with life, that's incredible. Considering the vast distances to be traveled, the endless places to search?
Dr. Bunnell nodded. But you see, from the time they achieved the means of traveling from star to star, they apparently decided it was their sacred duty to seek out other intelligences. In fact, it seems to have become a religion to them. He shook his head and sighed.
It's difficult to be sure we understand this, because even their excellent visual encyclopedia more readily describes physical things than it does philosophies. But we think they see themselves as servants of some supreme force that created the universe.
God?
Brendan interrupted.
Are you saying they see themselves as servants of God?
Something like that, Bunnell said. However, they aren't spreading any religious message. They simply feel they have a sacred obligation to help intelligent species find one another, to bind intelligences across the vast emptiness of space.
Bind, Falkirk said ominously, and he looked at his watch.
General Alvarado had been moving slowly to his right, putting himself at the periphery of the colonel's vision. He took another step. Ginger was increasingly uneasy about the undercurrent of antagonism between Falkirk and Bunnell and Alvarado, which she did not entirely understand. She moved closer to Dom and put an arm around him.
"And they bring another gift," Bunnell said, frowning toward the colonel. "They're such an ancient species that they've evolved certain abilities we think of as psychic. The ability to heal. Telekinesis. Other things. Not only have they evolved those talents, but they've learned to infuse the same abilities in other intelligent species that lack them.
Infuse, Dom said.
How?
We don't entirely understand, Bunnell said, but they can pass these powers along. That is evidently what was done with you, and now you have the ability to pass the power to others.
Pass the power,
Jack said, astonished. You mean Dom and Brendan could give us, or anyone, what they have?
I've already given it, Brendan said.
Ginger, Dom, Jack, you didn't hear the news Parker brought from Father Vikazic. Those two I healed in Chicago, Emmy and Winton, they've both got the power now.
New sources of infection, Falkirk said somberly.
And evidently, Parker said, since Brendan healed me, I'll have it too, sooner or later.
Although I don't think it's passed only in healing, Brendan said. It's just that the healing is such an intimate contact. Along with knitting up the tissues of the person you're healing, you somehow pass the power to them.
Ginger's mind reeled. This news was every bit as earth-shaking as the existence of the starship.
You mean... My God, you mean they came to help us evolve to a new level as a species? And that evolution is now already underway?
It would seem to be.
Yes,
Bunnell said. Looking at his wristwatch again, Leland Falkirk said,
Please, this masquerade is getting boring.
What masquerade? Faye Block asked. What are you talking about, Colonel? We were told you believe we've all been somehow possessed, some nonsense like that. How can you have gotten such a crazy idea?
Spare me this charade, Falkirk said sharply. You all pretend to know nothing. In reality, you know everything. Not one of you is human any longer. You're all possessed. And this innocence is play-acting to convince me to spare you, but it won't work. It's too late.
Repelled by Falkirk's air of madness, Ginger turned again to Bunnell.
What is all this stuff about infection and possession?
A mistake, Bunnell said, moving a few steps to his left. Ginger realized he was trying to pull the colonel's attention in that direction, away from General Alvarado, in order to give the general a better chance of slipping entirely out of Falkirk's notice.
A mistake, Bunnell repeated.
Or rather, an example of the human race's typical xenophobia, hatred and suspicion of strangers, of anyone that's different. When we first viewed some of the video discs I mentioned, when we first learned about the extraterrestrials' desire to pass these powers to other species, we apparently misinterpreted what we were seeing. Initially, we thought they were taking possession of those they changed, inserting an alien consciousness into a host body. I guess it's an understandable paranoia, after all the horror novels and movies. We thought perhaps we had a parasitical race on our hands, but that misapprehension was quickly dispelled when we'd seen more of their discs and had time to puzzle out some of the finer points. Now we know we were wrong.
I don't know it, Falkirk said. I think you were all infected, and then, under the control of these creatures, you began to downplay the danger. Or the discs are merely propaganda, lies.
No, Bunnell said. For one thing, I don't think these creatures would be capable of lying. Besides, if they could so easily take us over, they wouldn't require propaganda. And they sure as hell wouldn't bring us this encyclopedia that tells us they're going to change us.
Ginger had noticed Brendan Cronin following the discussion even more avidly than everyone else, and now he said,
I know the religious metaphor may not be entirely appropriate here, but if they feel they come to us as the servants of God, and if they come to hand down to us these miraculous gifts, then you could almost say they were angels, archangels bestowing special blessings.
Falkirk laughed harshly.
Oh, that's rich, Cronin. Do you really think you can get to me from a religious angle? Me? Even if I were a religious fanatic like my dead and rotting parents, I wouldn't buy these creatures as angels. Angels? With faces like buckets of worms?
Worms? What's he talking about? Brendan asked Bunnell.
The scientist said,
They look very different from us. Bipeds with four arms rather like us, yes, six digits instead of five, but that's about all we have in common in the way of looks. Initially they seem repulsive. In fact, repulsive is a mild word, but in time, you begin to see they have a certain beauty of their own.
Beauty of their own,
Falkirk said scornfully.
Monsters is what they are, and they'd only have beauty in the eyes of other monsters. So you've just proven my point, Bunnell.
Ginger's anger with Falkirk drove her to take a couple of steps toward him in spite of his submachine gun.
You damn fool, she said. What does it matter what they look like? The important thing is what they are, and evidently they're creatures with a deep sense of purpose. Noble purpose. No matter how different they look, the things we have in common with them are greater than our differences. My father always said that, as much as intelligence, the things that separated us from the beasts were courage, love, friendship, compassion, and empathy. Do you realize what courage it took for them to set out on this journey across God knows how many thousands of millions of miles? So that's one big thing we share with them. Courage. And love? Friendship? They must have those, too. Otherwise, how would they have built a civilization that could reach to the stars? You need love and friendship to have a reason to build. Compassion? They've got a mission to bring other intelligent species to a higher rung on the evolutionary ladder. Surely that takes compassion and empathy. Isn't that obvious? They empathize with our fear and loneliness,
with our dread that we're adrift in a meaningless universe, they empathize so much that they commit themselves to these incredible journeys on the mere hope of encountering us and bringing us the news that we are not alone.
Suddenly, she knew her anger wasn't directed so much at Falkirk as at this horrid blindness in the human species that led it frequently into spirals of self-destruction.
"Look at me,"
she told the colonel.
"I'm a Jew, and there are those who say I'm not the same as they are. Not as good, even dangerous. Stories of Jews drinking the blood of Gentile babies. There are the ignorant who believe that garbage. Is there any difference between that sick anti-Semitism and your stubborn insistence, in spite of all evidence to the contrary, that these creatures come to drink our blood? Let us go, for God's sake. Stop the endless hatred here. Stop it now. We have a destiny that leaves no room for hatred."
"Bravo," Falkirk said acidly. "A very nice speech." Even as he spoke, the colonel swung his machine gun toward General Alvarado and said, "Don't go for your gun, General. I assume you're carrying one. I won't be shot. I want to die in the glorious fire." "Fire," Bunnell said. Falkirk grinned.
"That's right, Doctor.
The glorious fire that will consume us all and save the world from this infection."
"Christ," Bunnell said.
"That's why you didn't bring more men with you. You didn't want to sacrifice more than necessary." He turned to Alvarado. "Bob, the crazy bastard's gotten into the tactical nukes."
Ginger knew that Alvarado was feeling precisely what she felt at this news, for his face twisted and went instantly gray.
"Two backpack nukes," Falkirk said.
"One right outside that door. The other in the main chamber downstairs." He checked his watch.
"Less than 3 minutes, and we'll all be vapor. Not even time left for you to change me, I'll bet. How long does it take to change one of us to one of you?"
"Longer than 3 minutes, I suppose."
Abruptly, the machine gun tore out of Falkirk's hands as if it had acquired life and taken flight, wrenching loose of his grasp with such force that it cut his fingers and tore off a couple of his nails. At the same instant, Lieutenant Horner screamed as his machine gun erupted from his grasp with equal suddenness and force. Ginger saw both weapons spin through the air and drop with a clatter, one at the feet of Ernie Block and the other at Jack Twist's side, both of whom jubilantly took up the guns and covered Falkirk and Horner.
"You?"
Ginger said wonderingly, turning to Dom.
"Me.
Yeah, I think," he said breathlessly. I didn't know I could do it until I had to. Sort of the way Brendan heals people."
Stunned, Dr. Bunnell said,
"But it doesn't matter." Falkirk said, 3 minutes.
"Two,"
Falkirk said, cradling one bleeding hand in the other and grinning happily.
2 minutes now."
"And backpack nukes can't be disarmed," Alvarado said.
Running, Dom shouted,
"Brendan, you take the one outside this door. I'll get the one downstairs. They can't be disarmed," Alvarado repeated.
Brendan knelt beside the nuclear device and winced when he saw the time remaining on the clock, 1:33. He didn't know what to do. He had healed 3 people, yes, and he had caused some pepper shakers to whirl through the air, and he had even generated light out of nothingness, but he remembered how the pepper shakers had gotten out of control, and how the chairs had leapt off the diner floor and smashed against the ceiling, and he knew if he made one false move with the detonator in this bomb, he would not be saved by all his superhuman power. 1:26. The others had come out of the cavern where the ship rested and had gathered around. Even Falkirk and Horner remained under guard, though there was no reason for them to try to get their guns. They trusted in the efficacy of the bomb. 1 minute, 11 seconds.
"If I smash the detonator," Brendan said to Alvarado, "pulverize it. Would that—"
"No," the general said. "Once armed, the detonator will trigger the bomb automatically if you try to wreck it."
103. Fay knelt beside him.
"Just make it pop right up out of the damn bomb, Brendan, the way Dom tore those guns out of their hands."
Brendan stared at the rapidly changing numerals on the detonator's clock and tried to imagine that entire device popping free of the rest of the bomb. Nothing happened. 54 seconds. Cursing the slowness of the elevator, Dom virtually flew out of the doors when they opened, with Ginger close behind him, and dashed to the backpack nuke standing in the center of the main cavern on the bottom level of Thunder Hill. Heart pounding even faster than his stomach was churning, he crouched beside the bomb and said, "Jesus," when he saw the digital clock. 50 seconds.
"You can do it,"
Ginger said, stooping at the other side of the hateful device.
"You've got a destiny."
"Here goes."
"Love you,"
she said.
"Love you,"
he said, as surprised as she was by that statement. 42 seconds. He raised his hands over the nuclear device, and he felt the rings appearing immediately in his palms. 40 seconds. Brendan had broken out in a sweat. 39 seconds. He strained, trying to work the magic that he knew was in him, but though the stigmata burned on his palms, and in spite of the fact that he could feel the power surging in him, he could not focus on the urgent task. He kept thinking about what could go wrong, and that in some way he would be responsible if it did go wrong, and the more he thought, the less he could direct the miraculous energy within him. 34 seconds. Parker Fane pushed between two onlookers and dropped to his knees beside Brendan.
"No offense, Father, but maybe the problem is that you, being a Jesuit, are just too damn prone to intellectualize. Maybe this requires going with your gut. Maybe what this needs is a wild-ass, go-for-it-try-anything-gonzo-berserker commitment of an artist."
He thrust his own large hands toward the detonator and shouted,
"Come out of there, you fucker!"
With a snap of wires, the detonator leapt out of its niche in the bomb package and straight into Parker's hands. There were cries of relief and congratulations, but Brendan said,
"The clock's still counting down."
11 seconds.
"Yeah, but it's not connected to the bomb anymore," Parker said, grinning broadly.
Alvarado said,
"But there's a conventional explosive charge in the damn detonator."
The detonator erupted out of the bomb into Dom's hands. He saw the clock still counting, and he sensed it had to be stopped even though there was no longer a chance of a nuclear explosion, so he simply willed it to stop, and the lighted numerals froze at 3. 3. Parker, unaccustomed to the role of magician, panicked at this secondary crisis. Certain his power was depleted, he chose a course of action perfectly in character. With a war cry to rival John Wayne in one of the Duke's old movies, Parker turned and threw the detonator toward the far wall of the cavern as if lobbing a grenade. He knew he could not cast it clear to the other side of the chamber, but he hoped he could pitch it far enough. Even as it left his hand, he flung himself to the floor, as the others had already done. Dom was kissing Ginger when the explosion sounded overhead, and they both jumped. For an instant, he thought Brendan had failed to disarm the other device, then realized a nuclear explosion would have brought the ceiling down on them.
"The detonator," she said.
"Come on, let's see if anyone's hurt."
The lift crawled upward. When they arrived at the second level, the main chamber was filled with scores of depository staff members, all carrying guns and responding to the sound of battle. Holding Ginger's hand, Dom pushed through the crowd toward the place where he had left Brendan with the first backpack nuke. He saw Fay, Sandy, and Ned, then Brendan, alive, unhurt. Georgia. Marcy. Parker loomed on his right and gave both him and Ginger a bear hug.
You should have seen me, kids. If they'd had both me and Artie Murphy, World War II would have been over in about 6 months.
I'm beginning to see why Dom admires you so, Ginger said. Parker raised his eyebrows.
But of course, my dear, to know me is to love me.
A sudden cry of alarm rose, which jolted Dom, because he thought all danger was past. When he turned, he saw that Falkirk had dodged away from Jack and Ernie in the turmoil and had wrenched a revolver from one of the Thunder Hill staff. Everyone fell back from him.
"For Christ's sake!" Jack shouted. "It's over, Colonel! It's over, damn you!"
But Falkirk had no intention of resuming his private war. His gray, translucent eyes shone with madness.
"Yes," he said. "It's over. And I won't be changed like the rest of you. You won't get me!"
Before anyone could reach him, or before anyone could think to tear the weapon from his hands with telekinetic power, he thrust the barrel of the revolver into his mouth and pulled the trigger. With a cry of horror, Ginger looked away from the falling corpse, and Dom turned his head, too. It was not the bloody death itself that repelled, but the stupid, pointless waste when at last humankind had within its grasp the secret of immortality. 3. Transcendence. As the staff of Thunder Hill filled the cavern, milling around the ship that most had never seen before, Ginger and Dom and the other witnesses followed Miles Bunnell into the vessel. The interior was not dramatic, but as plain as the exterior, with none of the complex and powerful machinery that one expected in a craft capable of such a journey. Miles Bunnell explained that the builders had advanced beyond machinery as humankind understood it, perhaps even beyond physics as humankind understood it. There was one long chamber within, and it was for the most part gray, drab, featureless. The warm, golden luminosity which had filled the vessel on the night of July 6th, and which Brendan had remembered in his dreams, was not visible now. There was only a line of ordinary work lights that the scientists had strung for their convenience. In spite of its plainness, the chamber had a warmth, appeal, and magic that, strangely enough, reminded Ginger of her father's private office at the back of his first jewelry store in Brooklyn, the one he always used as his headquarters. The walls of that sanctum sanctorum had been decorated only with a calendar, and the furniture had been inexpensive, old and well used, plain, even drab. But for Ginger it had been a fine and magical room, because Jacob had seldom worked there, but had squirreled away with one book or another, from which he'd often read to her. Sometimes it would be a mystery, or a fantasy about gnomes and witches, a story of other worlds, or a thriller about spies. And when Jacob read, his voice acquired a resonant and mesmerizing timbre. The reality of that gray little office faded, and for hours Ginger could believe herself to be investigating with Sherlock Holmes upon the misty moors, celebrating with the hobbit, Mr. Bilbo Baggins, inside the hill at Bag End, or with Jim and Will as they explored the terrible carnival in Mr. Bradbury's lovely book. Jacob's office hadn't been only what it seemed to be, and although this ship bore no physical resemblance to Jacob's office, it was similar in that it was more than it appeared. Under its drab skin it harbored wondrous things, great mysteries. Spaced along each long wall were four coffin-like containers of a semi-transparent, milky-blue substance that looked like carved quartz. These were, Miles Bunnell explained, the beds in which the travelers had passed their long journey in a state of near-suspended animation, aging only the equivalent of one Earth year for every 50 that passed. As they dreamed, the fully automated ship proceeded through the void, reaching ahead with an array of sensors and probes for indications of life in the hundreds of thousands of solar systems that it passed. It did not escape Ginger's notice that the top of each container was marked by two raised rings, precisely the size of those that had appeared in Dom's and Brendan's hands.
"You told us they were dead when they got here," Ned reminded Bunnell. "But you never answered my question. What did they die from?"
"Time," Bunnell said. Although the ship and all its devices continued to function well right through the descent and the landing there along I-80, the occupants had perished of old age long before they ever got here.
Faye said, "But you've told us they aged 1 year for every 50 that passed."
"Yes," Bunnell said. "And from what we've learned about them, they're long-lived by our standards. 500 years seems to be their average lifespan." Standing with Marcy in his arms, Jack Twist said, "But, my God, at 1 year for 50, they'd have to have been traveling 25,000 years to have died of old age."
"Longer," Bunnell said. "In spite of their vast knowledge and technology, they never found a way to exceed the speed of light. 186,000 miles per second. In fact, their ship cruises at 98% of that, something like 182,000 miles per second.
Fast, yes, but not fast enough when you consider the distances involved. Our own galaxy, in which there are neighbors, has a diameter of 80,000 light-years, or about 240,000 trillion miles. They tried to pinpoint the location of their home world for us through tri-dimensional galactic diagrams. We believe they come from a place more than 31,000 light-years around the perimeter of the galaxy from us. And since they traveled at just under the speed of light, that means they left home a little less than 32,000 years ago. Even with their lives extended by suspended animation, they must have perished nearly 10,000 years ago.
Ginger found herself shaking again, as she had shaken upon first turning her gaze upon the ancient ship. She touched the nearest of the milky blue containers, which seemed to her to be a powerful testimony to compassion and empathy beyond human understanding, the embodiment of a sacrifice that staggered the mind and humbled the heart. To have willingly given up the comforts of home, to have left their world and all their kind to travel such distances on the mere hope of being able to help a struggling species at the far, far end? Bunnell's voice had grown lower as he spoke, and now it was as soft as if he had been speaking in a church.
"They died 25,000 light-years from home. They were already dead when humankind still lived in caves and was just beginning to learn the basics of agriculture. When these incredible journeyers died, the entire population of our world was only about 5 million, fewer people than now live in New York alone. During the past 10,000 years, while we've struggled out of the dirt and broken our backs to build a shaky civilization, always teetering on the edge of destruction, those 8 dead seekers were coming steadily toward us across the vastness of the galactic rim." Ginger saw Brendan touch the other corner of the coffin on which she had rested her own hands. Tears glistened in his eyes. She knew what he was thinking. As a priest, he had taken vows of poverty and celibacy, and had forsworn many of the pleasures of secular life as an offering to God. He knew the meaning of sacrifice, but none of his sacrifices compared to what these beings had given up in the name of their cause.
Parker said, "But to have found 5 other intelligent species
when the distances are so great and the odds so small. They must send out a great many of these ships.
We think they dispatch hundreds a year, maybe even thousands, and had been doing so for longer than 100,000 years before this vessel left port. As I said, it's their religion and their racial purpose combined. All the other 5 species they discovered were within 15,000 light-years from their world. And remember, even when they locate an intelligence at that distance, they don't know of it until 15,000 years after the discovery, for it takes that long for the message of the contact to reach home again. Are you beginning to grasp the depth and scale of their commitment?
Most ships, Ernie said, must go out and never come back, and never meet with any success. Most of them just cruise on and on into endless space while the crew perishes, as this crew perished.
Yes, Bunnell said. And yet they keep going, Dom said. And yet they keep going, Bunnell said.
We may never meet others of them face to face, Ned said.
Give humanity 100 years to learn to apply all the knowledge and technology they brought us, Bunnell said. Then give us another, at least 1,000 years more, to mature to the point where we're capable of making that same commitment. Then a ship will be launched, manned by a human crew in suspended animation. And possibly we'll find a way to improve the process so that they don't age at all or age far more slowly. None of us will be alive to watch it take off, but it will go. I know in my heart it will. Then, 32,000 years after that, our distant descendants will be there, returning the call, remaking the contact these creatures don't even know they've established. They stood in stunned silence, trying to grasp the immensity of what Bunnell envisioned. Ginger felt a chill of the most delicious and indescribable nature. Brendan said,
"It's God's scale. We're talking about thinking, planning, and doing on God's scale rather than mankind's."
Parker said,
"Sort of makes it a whole lot less important who's going to win this year's World Series, doesn't it?"
Dom put his hands upon the rings that were featured on the top of that particular suspended animation chamber around which everyone was gathered. He said, "I believe only 6 of the crew were dead, fully dead, that night in July, Dr. Bunnell. I'm beginning to recall what happened when we entered this ship, and I feel as if we were called to 2 of these containers by something that still lived within them, barely lived, but was not yet entirely dead."
"Yes,"
Brendan said, tears weaving down his cheeks now. "In fact, I remember the golden light was coming from 2 of these boxes, and that it exerted not only an obvious but subliminal attraction. I was compelled to come and put my hands upon the rings, and when I put them here, somehow I knew that beneath the lid something was desperately clinging to life, not for its own sake, but for the sake of passing on some gift. And by putting its own hands against the inner surface of those conductive rings, it gave me what it had come so far to give. Then it died at last. I didn't know what was in me then, exactly. I suppose it would have taken some time to understand, to learn how to use the power. But before I ever had a chance, we were taken into custody."
"Alive,"
Bunnell said, shocked, fascinated.
"Well, the condition of the 8 bodies. 2 were virtually turned to dust. 2 more were badly decomposed, apparently because their suspended animation boxes had shut down once they died. 4 were in much better condition, and 2 seemed perfectly preserved. But we never dared imagine
Yes,
Dom said, clearly recalling more.
Just barely alive, but holding on to pass the gift. Of course, I expected to be interrogated, to have a chance to tell what had happened to me in the ship, but the government was so eager to protect society from the shock of contact, and then so afraid of the unknown. I never had the chance to tell.
Soon,
Bunnell said, we can tell the world.
And change the world,
Brendan said. Ginger looked at the faces of the Tranquility family, at Parker and Bunnell, and sensed the bond that would soon exist between all men and women, an incredible closeness that would arise from their sudden shared leap up the evolutionary ladder toward a better world. No more would people be strangers, one to another, not anywhere on Earth. All prior human history had been lived in the dark, and now they stood at the gates of a new dawn. She looked at her two small hands, a surgeon's hands, and she thought of the decade-long studies to which she had diligently applied herself with the hope of saving lives. Now, perhaps all that training would be for nothing. She didn't care. She was filled with joy at the prospect of a world that did not need medicine or surgery. Soon, when Dom had passed the gift to her, as she would ask him to, she'd be able to heal with her touch. More important, with only her touch, she would be able to pass on to others the power to heal themselves. The human lifespan would increase dramatically overnight. 300, 400, even 500 years. Except for accidents, the specter of death would be banished to a distant horizon. No more would husbands have to sit in mourning at the deathbeds of young wives. No more. Baruch Hashem. No more. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Strangers by Dean Kuntz. Copyright 1986 by Nkui Incorporated. Read by Dick Hill. Directed by Susie Breck. Performance copyright 2008 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.